Hi, this is Zoe Routh, Director of Inner Compass. I'm here today with Dr. David Cook, the Managing Director of Konica Minolta in Australia. And I met David in June of this year at a speakership workshop and was very impressed with some of the things he was doing with Konica Minolta and culture. And I invited him to share his story about what he's done and the effect it's had there. And so here we are today. Welcome, David.
Thanks very much, Zoe.
Well, I'd love to start off with you just giving us an idea of what is Konica Minolta, particularly in Australia, because I think we're familiar with it being a big Japanese brand. So what's your role and how does Konica Minolta fit into Australia?
Yeah, so I'm the managing director for Australia, and I guess my claim to fame is that I'm the first non-Japanese managing director that's been appointed here in the company's 30-year history in Australia. So traditionally, somebody will be sent out from head office, quite possibly somebody that's never been to Australia or worked in this market, and they'll be here for a few years and until they go back and be replaced with another person from head office. But about 15 months ago, they decided to break that mold, and I'd been in the company as the executive general manager for about 8 years at that point, and I was appointed into this role. So basically what the company is we're a wholly owned subsidiary of Konica Minolta Inc. in Japan, which is a global technology company. And they're a manufacturer principally of hardware that sits on corporate networks and prints and scans and faxes and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that has been occurring globally, and I've certainly been looking to do here locally as well, is to migrate the company from a purely hardware-centric provider to be a much more all-encompassing solutions provider for our clients, where we can have a real discussion about some of the business challenges that a company is facing and offer a broader range of solutions, which typically will involve software, which is synergistic with our hardware, so we can start to do things like assist them with their document management, scanning and print management and security of documents on their network and that kind of stuff.
So not only did you, you had two incredible milestones at the beginning there. So you were the first non-Japanese managing director and you were spearheading a change of business focus as well.
Yes, yeah, the two things pretty much coincided. It's been acknowledged that you can't just remain a hardware manufacturer forever. It's too difficult to differentiate yourself. The products are becoming too similar, and you really need to have a deeper conversation with your clients if they're going to see you as a true partner rather than just somebody they buy something from. And if you go back, I'm not even sure what it is now, it's probably 20 years, you will have seen IBM as probably one of the first big hardware manufacturers to make that migration into services.
Mm-hmm. And that this migration goes with what I've read. I think I've read it on your website about the outside-in approach to business, where you're doing just that. You're taking deeply consulting with the client to better serve them. And I'm wondering how that outside-in customer focus permeates the culture of your organization.
Yeah, it's a good question. We have really just taken our first baby steps in that direction, down that path, to be honest. And the outside-in approach is a little bit different to simply solution selling. So with solution selling, our salespeople, and we're a direct sales, we're a B2B organization, we don't do any consumer or sales over the net or things like that, but our salespeople will sit down and talk in a more comprehensive way with our clients about their businesses to see if we can provide some solutions to pain points and challenges and so on. Now, the outside-in approach really is, it's a lot broader than that. It's something that we've embarked on that really involves every single person in the company, because our view is that the customer experience is not just going to be with the salesperson and perhaps with some ongoing account management, but it's going to be with numerous people across the organization, and they may have to ring up to question a bill on some occasion or to chase something up or to order consumables for their devices or just engage with us in any number of ways. And the concept of outside in is for the entire company to embrace the importance of the customer and put them at the heart of everything we do.
So let's talk a little bit about the culture in your organization. Now, you were 8 years within that culture, and yet when you became managing director, you started some shifts that had ripple effects. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, look, the main thing really was that when we talk about culture, we're kind of talking about, culture is a little bit hard to define, but culture outside of a corporate environment or maybe even a family environment tends to mean different nationalities tend to have different traits that are the norms within that society. So if you just look at that cultural aspect for a moment, we're a Japanese company operating in Australia and, of course, America and Europe and other places. So immediately you get some contrasts there, and particularly if the company is being run by, in our case, a Japanese person, as it always had been previously, and I guess particularly if that person has not had a great deal of contact with different national cultures, then it's going to be quite difficult for that company to be most effective in serving the needs of, in our particular case, Australian people and Australian businesses. So the first thing I really needed to do was to identify what were the structures within our company in Australia and the norms of behaviour in our company, and I guess the attitudes from staff and so on, that were really representative of a Japanese culture rather than being representative of a culture that could interact more effectively with Australian people and businesses. And some of the things I found that I needed to change were things like it was a very hierarchical system. So the managing director sat at the top. He was fairly distant from the staff. To go to his office would be considered a great privilege, and he would kind of manage from afar, if you like. Also, so that there really didn't need to be a great deal of involvement from the person at the top, there were silos that were set up, each with a general manager sitting over the top of them. So you had, you know, HR and legal and sales and marketing and operations and service and so on. And each of these general managers virtually ran a company of their own inside the company. So the very first thing I sought to do was to firstly make myself, as the most senior person in the company, very, very accessible, get out there and talk to people, get to know how they really felt about the organization, listen to their, ask them, please tell me, how can we build a better company here? And also break down those silos between the organizations. So I did a number of things. A couple of very overt acts, I guess, on almost day one was I never actually moved into the former managing director's office. I turned it into a staff lounge, and most of this staff had never, ever been through that doorway. So that became their property, if you like. I moved into a glass-fronted office in a high-traffic area where everybody could see me. Second thing I did was there was a big wall, physical wall, between HR and the rest of the business, and they were shut off from the employees to a large degree. I had that wall removed, and which provided much greater access to people, to HR and HR to the staff. And I systematically just went around the company looking for areas that typified the old culture, which represented what would be considered quite fair and reasonable and normal in Japan, but didn't really resonate well with Western employees here in Australia.
Oh, wow. So that's just listening to you, it sounds like you did an environmental stock take of structures and symbols that sort of represented those cultural norms, and then went about shifting them. So it's interesting, from identifying what doesn't work, how did you know what would work?
That's a great question. Well, I didn't consider myself a font of all knowledge on that subject, and I'd never been a managing director before. I felt I was quite competent with my own, within my own sphere of influence, but I'd never actually had the responsibility for pulling every area of a company together into one cohesive unit before. So I had some intuitive feel for that, but I thought I would go and get the opinions of everybody else. So we actually had a consultancy firm come in called Market Culture, who've done a lot of this sort of work before, both here in Australia and also in the US. It's just a small organization, but they're really quite on the money when it comes to this kind of thing. And I had a good feel for what they might be able to help us achieve. And one of the first things they did was that they did an online survey of all staff, which had a very high participation rate. It was in the 90s from our staff, which they said was very, very high. And what that said to me was that the staff actually wanted a voice. For years, they'd probably wanted to give an opinion and be heard and know that their opinion counted. And we asked them a whole range of questions about, you know, did they think we were a customer-centric organization or not? You know, we probed into things like, did they feel that there was gender equality in the organization, racial equality? What ideas did they have that we could, whereby we could improve the organization? And about 400 people out of 440, I think, responded. And there were also free text fields where people could actually write comments apart from just ticking boxes and things like that. And we got 800 separate comments from people, some of those very, very lengthy comments, actually. And one of the last questions which I added to the survey, which wasn't previously there from other surveys that Market Culture had done, were, do you think that the senior management of Konica Minolta will do anything with these answers? And yeah, and you know, we got some tough love back. And when we were put on the scale of being compared to all of other Market Culture's previous clients, we actually sat at the 30th percentile for being a customer-centric organization. So 7 out of 10 organizations I'd worked with previously were better than we were. And that didn't completely shock me. And the reason I was doing a survey in the first place was that I knew we had to move and I knew we had to improve. So that was fine. But that just gave us a stake in the ground. So it gave us a mathematical measurement to, in the future, it will be later this year, measure ourselves against. But it also gave us this rich harvest of views from our staff. Many of these ideas we've been able to now start to develop in the business, and which has been great.
Mm. So that sounds like a very sensible, structured approach to it. And it's interesting, you know, will the management do anything about it? So obviously,
yeah.
The slap about the jowls had an effect, or was noted, and you started to implement some of these things. Some of them were symbolic and structural, like removing walls and changing offices. What has been the effect on your company's culture?
Okay, well, look, I think the first thing is that the probably the most major effect is that people have immediately become more engaged with the company itself because we asked them their opinion. And we implemented some stuff, and we told them we're going to implement some more stuff. So immediately, they're a part of it. It's not just stuff that some managers are doing. They're a part of it. And people come up to me all the time in the lunchroom or corridors, car park, wherever, and they just say, look, I've never felt really a part of this company. I had one person say to me, I've worked here for 25 years, and I never really used to talk to people much about where I worked. But now I tell everybody where I work because I feel really proud of the company. Now, we're not there yet, but they can see that we're genuine and things are shifting. So some of the things they asked for instance, were more communication. We beaver away all day working hard at our jobs. We get to the end of the month where, you know, budgets have been chased and so on. We don't actually know what the budgets are during the month. and we don't know what the result was at the end of the month. We just turn up on the first of the new month and go through the routine again, but we're never told whether the organization is successful or not. So, you know, really, really simple thing. I write to all of our staff several times a month. I normally write in the middle of the month with more sort of social stuff in a way, or maybe some big wins we've had, or just a bit of newsy stuff. Mm-hmm. But then at the very start of the new month, I give them our financial results. And I give them the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I tell them, you know, how we went against the previous year, what the trends are, which parts of the business did particularly well. Obviously, pat a number of people on the back, or maybe whole branches or states by naming them. And so just that simple act of everybody knowing what's going on, we've been able to develop a culture of engagement rather than an inclusion, rather than a culture of exclusion, where you had managers that knew and everybody else that didn't know how the company was performing. So I think in a way that's been one of the most significant things. And one of the next steps we're about to embark on are what we're calling cross-functional workshops, which will be facilitated. They won't have senior managers in the room, and we'll get a number of staff together that have possibly never even talked to each other before. They might be from completely different departments or different parts of the building or what have you. And we'll have them in a room, and we'll continue to probe down this line of how do we build a better company, and what are we doing well, and how do you think the progress has gone so far, and what are some of the important things that have slipped off our radar, and how do you think we're doing? Do you think we've made any strides with gender equality, and things of that nature? And then we'll, you know, collate all of that feedback, and that'll be impetus for kind of the next wave of change to keep us going.
That's great. And I love the cross-functional aspect of that, because that sort of helps what is referred to as the bridge culture by Kathy Sorensen and Kurt Kaufman in their book, Culture Eats Strategy for Lunch.
Yeah.
And it's important that you do that, too, because the attempt to break down silos means that you need good bridge culture between those little micro cultures. So I think that's going to produce two results for you. One is introducing people across the silos, and two, getting cross-fertilization of ideas, which is great.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you see, we have about a third of our people, I think it would be, that are actually out of the office most of the day. So they're salespeople and account managers, and they're field service technicians that go out and fix stuff and what have you. So for those people, you know, often, say, the field service engineers, they might only drop into a branch once a week, or sometimes just once a month for a team meeting or something of that nature. We even have sort of parts depots set up around the metro areas where it's they don't have to travel back to the office all the time to get something that they need. So it's more important than ever, I think, in with a workforce like that, that you set up mechanisms where you just keep in touch with people all the time. And I had an interesting little situation the other day where I got in about 8 o'clock, and there was somebody there, and immediately came into my office. I didn't even have a chance to sort of put my laptop in the docking station, and they said, "Oh, could I see you, please?" And, you know, they're not one of the more senior people in the company by any means, but I said, yeah, come on in. And she proceeded to tell me some of the things she didn't think that I was doing well enough or fast enough or what have you.
Good on her.
Yeah, it was great. And I, of course, encouraged her to keep talking and tell me all these things. And she actually said, you know, there are some things I actually like about the old company better than the new company. And what that was a reference to was the pace of change regarding some things we're doing within her particular department were causing her concern, because they were sort of shaking some of the old norms. And she's somebody who had adapted really well to the old way of doing things and just kind of bunkered down and just kind of accepted the way it was and had built a little environment that she could survive in and work in really well. And now all of a sudden, everything was changing, and so this was kind of a difficult time for her. But the interesting thing when she spoke to me was, I didn't say this to her, but I thought to myself, yes, but one of the good things about the new environment is that in the past, you would never, ever have been able to walk into the managing director's office and constructively criticize him. And I think that point had kind of escaped her, that that was one of the good things about the new Konica Minolta, that here she was sitting in the MD's office, you know, telling him how he needed to lift his game. And I, you know, I didn't point it out to her, but I thought it was kind of a wonderful irony in a way, and a verification that there, you know, there are some good things happening.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, what a nice way for you to be able to see all that at once. One of the things I wanted to pick up on that you said, mentioned earlier, was this a notion of communication and reporting and doing that sort of on a monthly basis against plans and results. How do you celebrate success, and what is success for your company?
Yes, well, I mean, you've got the obvious financial success, which is, you know, do we hit our numbers? Do we sell enough units? Do we make enough profit? Do we grow our market share and all those kind of metrics? But look, I think success is more about the inputs, and those financial things are just the outputs that come as a natural consequence, I think. And success for me, and I don't want to sort of, you know, get the violins playing too much here, but for me, you know, really, you know, if the staff are happy and they're engaged and they like working at Konica Minolta, and they tell their friends that they like working at Konica Minolta, and they tell other people that if they're looking for a new job, they should seriously consider our company because it's a great place to work. And if we have happy customers that are complimenting us and, you know, on our responsiveness and the fact that we're prepared to listen to them and their needs and do whatever we can to assist them in their businesses, then for me, you know, that's kind of the measure of success, I think. And possibly the other dimension to that also is that if I can feel in my heart of hearts that we're also making some kind of a difference in society as a whole as we go about our day-to-day business of selling widgets and or whatever, then I think I'll count that as a pretty good indicator of success.
And that's let's pick up on that last point about making a difference to society as a whole. Now, you've written a whole PhD on this notion of corporate social responsibility and different aspects of it. Could you tell us a little bit about how you and Konica Minolta take that aspect of your work and bring it to life? So what is it that you and Konica Minolta do to help contribute to society?
Yeah, okay. Well, firstly, I don't think that we're changing society as such or anything like that. I think we're a very minor contributor, but I think the important thing is that we are a contributor. We've made a conscious decision in our own small way, in our own small part of the world, to make a contribution outside of our day-to-day business operations. And the thesis that I did asked a very simple, non-academic question of large companies in Australia. And the question was, why do profit-making corporations give their money away to the not-for-profit sector? So I was targeting the people that already, or the companies that already do, that are engaged. And I wanted to know why they did it. Because on one level, it could seem a bit counterintuitive that all of these people work really hard to make a profit, and then the company or various, you know, senior managers in the company, the board or whatever, they make a decision to give a whole pile of it away. It could seem, taken from one angle, that that's a very strange thing to do. And if you go back to some years ago, probably into the 90s, or actually 2002, there's quite a famous quote from the Australian Shareholders Association, which was that no Australian publicly listed company should ever give any money away to charity. Money belongs to the shareholders, and the company has no right to give it away. Mm. So my thesis really was looking into that argument, but asking the companies that did give their money away, okay, well, why don't you believe that that's the case? Why don't you subscribe to that theory? Because there seems to be some logic there. And what I found was 100% of the responses I got back, if I were to put it in its crudest term, was that there's an ROI on CSR. In other words, there's a return on investment on corporate social responsibility. And these big companies spoke to me about how they'd been able to create goodwill, how they'd been able to differentiate their brands, how they'd been able to hire better, brighter grads out of uni, you know, young Gen Y people looking for more meaning in the workplace other than just their salary. So these companies developed not-for-profit partnerships and relationships so that staff could have volunteering days off, and they could put in matched giving, salary match giving programs, so staff could donate and have that money matched by the company. So there could be team building days working inside those not-for-profit partners and so on. So all of these organizations, none of them actually said to me, oh, we give money away to the not-for-profit sector because we're good corporate citizens. Of course, there's an element of that, but largely they said we had a problem to solve, and it might have been recruitment, might have been an issue with longevity of staff, not being able to, engender staff loyalty to their organization, might have been a branding positioning, a challenge in the market or whatever. And they said the way we found to solve that problem was by going to the not-for-profit sector and working with them and sharing some of the goodwill that they've been able to generate in society and getting kind of a halo effect, I guess, from that goodwill. Now, the great thing about that is that these pragmatic, profit-generating organizations driven by shareholder dividends and all that kind of stuff were able to achieve their aims while at the same time providing funding and resources and, in some cases, knowledge and expertise to charities who desperately needed that that funding and those resources. So they were actually each able to share what they had with the other. So it's a completely win-win situation. And I guess my thesis, the purpose of my thesis and some lecturing I've done since and some articles I've written since and me banging the drum to anybody who'll listen is that, hey, there's this amazing situation where both the not-for-profit world and the corporate world can work together for their complete mutual benefit and achievement of their own and each other's aims. So I think it's just it's a fantastic relationship. And often people think they're so different. How could they actually, even engage with each other? It's because they're so different that they have so much to give to each other.
Yeah, and I like that. I like your whole premise that it's a symbiotic relationship, and it's not just a crass, this is good for our social license, i.e. we do it begrudgingly, and therefore we can do what we really want to do, which is plunder the earth and, exploit the people or whatever gargantuan tale is being told about big corporates. And I love the fact that it's mutually beneficial. Having worked in the not-for-profit sector for 25 years, I know the challenges of resourcing. And to work with a company that is for-profit and partners with a not-for-profit is a great concept. And that's what I think not-for-profits don't do well. They go cap in hand looking for money as opposed to looking for a partner.
Yeah, I agree. And what I've been saying in some lectures I've done at not-for-profit conferences is the value of something typically is due to its scarcity. So pebbles on the side of the road aren't very valuable. Diamonds are. There are fewer diamonds than there are pebbles. It kind of works that way. And what the big companies have is money. But money's not scarce. The corporate world is awash with trillions of dollars. So there's no scarcity of money. So this illusion that money is something that's incredibly valuable, I think it is an illusion because money's not scarce. But if you look at what the not-for-profit world has, the not-for-profit world has the ability to just absolutely enlighten employees inside companies through the interaction of that employee with the not-for-profits organization and their staff, and in some cases even the parts of the community that they serve. So, you know, if you take a corporate person and they're working at a hostel for homeless people or whatever, serving meals or what have you, that person that's gone into that environment, they've been touched. They will become a more enlightened human being. Now, the corporate world has no way, I can't think of any way that they can turn their employees into more enlightened people, or I can't find a quicker or more effective way of doing it than putting them in touch with all aspects of society, particularly some of the areas of society in great need, through these not-for-profit partners. And there was a great experience I had when I went to Westpac, and somebody told me about a program they have for senior executives where they can volunteer to go up to the Gulf of Carpentaria and live up there and work in Indigenous communities for a period of time, teaching them microfinancing skills and microcredit and things like that. And the person looked around the open plan floor and I said, "Oh, are you looking for one of the people so I could talk to them?" And they said, "Oh, not necessarily. I'm just looking because if one of them was on the floor at their workstation, I would then ask you to tell me who on the floor out there of 100 people was the one who'd gone up there." And I said, "Well, how would I possibly know out of 100 people?" And this person said to me, "Because you'd be able to see it on their face." And I thought, "Oh, incredibly powerful." Yeah, and
that
I
makes
said,
me
really?
Want to weep.
Yeah, and the person said, "I absolutely promise you, you'd be able to pick out the ones that have been up there." So that's the power of a not-for-profit partner, connecting people with truth and reality in society and a deeper meaning. And if that employee then says, "Who gave me that deeper meaning?" My employer did. The bank that I worked for gave me that greater meaning in my life. And of course that flows into their family relationships and friendships and everything else. Then that is something that money can't buy. And that's the power of not-for-profit organizations. And one of the not-for-profits I interviewed in the study was the Breast Cancer Network of Australia. And every year they get 15,000 people to go to the MCG, Melbourne Cricket Ground, wearing a pink poncho, and they create their logo, which is a silhouette of a pink woman. They stand in the middle of that football field, and then there's a shot taken from a helicopter up above, and it's absolutely amazing to see this logo that's been formed out of these 15,000 people. Now, if any company in Australia, I don't care how wealthy they are, what resources they have, how famous they are, it's a mining company, a bank, a telco, a pharmaceutical company, if they send out a message, "Hey, we're looking for 15,000 volunteers to come and make a big tea for Telstra in the middle of a football field," nobody would turn up. Like, seriously, just nobody would be interested, but there's this relatively small charity can just send a message out, and through the goodwill that they've generated amongst their constituency, people just rally and they turn up, and probably mostly it's cold and rainy night or something, so it's kind of at night they take this shot, and that's the power of these organizations. And so the not-for-profit world has a lot of characteristics that the corporate world does not have, but desperately wants and desperately needs to be more effective. And the not-for-profit world, of course, needs to tap into some of the wealth of the corporate world to achieve their aims. So, again, I just think it's there are amazing possibilities for the two to get together.
And what is it that you've done with Konica Minolta to do that something similar in your organization?
Yeah, so we invited our staff to actually vote for a not-for-profit partner in three categories. And the categories were health, environment, and social. And so we created partnerships with the Breast Cancer Network of Australia, with land care in the environmental category, and with the Smith family in the social category. And apart from providing some funding for them every year, we also engage with them regularly throughout the year. And actually, what we also did after that vote took place, I went to Cambodia, and I met a woman over there called Somali Mam, who had been trafficked as a young woman into the whole sort of system of sexual slavery over there, but had managed to escape and had set up an organization to help rescue, rehabilitate, and reintegrate others in Cambodia. And I was so touched by that, and around the same time, I also became aware of an Australian, a small Australian-based charity called Project Futures, who had been established by a young woman here called Stephanie Lorenzo after reading Somali Mam's book to raise funds for the work in Cambodia. And so we added Project Futures as a fourth partner, and we created a fourth category called Humanitarian, and we work with them quite closely. And so we're volunteering as possible. So, for instance, Landcare is they're really good at doing that. We have staff go and do bush regeneration. We do that. We have people come from those organizations and talk at morning teas. We take tables at their fundraising functions. And we just engage with them, you know, wherever we can and however we can. And they're also the recipients of our matched giving program, where we will match dollar for dollar any staff donations to those partners.
That's great. And do you have those light in people's faces moments with your employees with some of these programs?
Yeah. Well, we haven't gone nearly as far as Westpac and had people go and you know, live somewhere else for a period of time. But it's really on my radar, actually. It would be a massive mind shift for our Japanese head office if I told them that I'm taking some people out of the business and they're going to go, you know, live in Nepal for a month or whatever. But I'm really looking forward to the day when I actually do it and break a few boundaries there. But but we did send a couple of people over to run a half marathon around Angkor Wat in Siem Reap in Cambodia as a fundraiser for the organization over there that Project Future supports. And they came back and they're just really fired up. And again, you know, if you spoke to either of those guys, one out of our Brisbane office and one out of our Melbourne office, they're kind of their enthusiasm for having been over there, having seen the work of the charity on the ground there, and their thankfulness that Connor Kaminalta gave them that opportunity is just really infectious. They kind of just run around and tell everybody, including clients as well. And I have a lot of our clients say to me, I just think it's fantastic what you guys at Connor Kaminalta are doing. And we actually have some direct examples of where organizations that have dealt with our competitors for years and years and years have said to us, I'm now dealing with you, and the reason I am is because of the work that you do with your charity partners. That's the definitive answer. Now, again, we didn't necessarily set out as that as the aim. If anything, if somebody said, well, you know, why did you sort of do it? Why did you form these not-for-profit partnerships and give time off to staff, time off to volunteer and all that kind of stuff? To some extent, I probably would have said self-indulgently, I wanted to test the theories that were in my thesis. I wanted to have a live case study that was kind of the company I ran. And I would have felt it was a little bit strange if I didn't apply some of the learnings that I took by speaking to some companies that had received these benefits. But there's a little bit of a clue, I think, as to what angle a company is taking. If you look at where does the budget for the donations to the charities or the match giving or whatever, where does that budget live inside the company? And if it lives inside the marketing department, there's probably a bit of a message there that they're looking for brand differentiation and brand building and goodwill as a brand and so on. And I think that's, you know, absolutely fine. If it lives inside the HR department, it's probably a little bit more to do with staff engagement and being able to talk about this in interviews when you're seeking to attract new staff. Probably a little bit about building loyalty from staff to stay longer within the organization and overcome the very high cost of having to replace staff these days because of, you know, recruitment fees and loss of corporate knowledge and having to train somebody from afresh and all that kind of stuff. Now, at Connick Minolta, our budget lives inside the HR department. So for me, it's a bit more about people rather than about the commercial outcomes in the marketplace.
And that's a very, it's a very symbolic message and feeds into what you're trying to develop with your culture as well.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. It all sort of fits in, you know, very, very nicely. And even the lady who sort of wandered into my office and sat me down and, you know, told me a few home truths from her perspective, which was wonderful, said to me, "Oh, by the way, I do really like all the charity stuff that we're doing now."
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. That's just a beautiful little synopsis. David, thank you so much for your time today. I have loved all your stories, and I could spend a long, long time talking with you about different initiatives and projects and how we can make a big contribution or small contribution to society through the work that we do. And I think the work that you're doing in your business and just being who you are is a fantastic contribution. So thanks again for all your time.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for your interest, Zoe.